I read something on your website or your bio, and you said it was apparent, you know, that both Vaughn brothers had something special, and it was no surprise when they became successful. What was that, quote, something special for each of them? And do you have any idea, you know, just again, in your opinion, where that came from or why did that exist even?
Well, no, I mean, you can't really. I mean, you know, they're not the only people. I know that you know people that, I mean, there's always been people that, even in their youth, just showed that, I mean, you know, they just stuck out. You know, they just stuck out, whether it was an artist or a writer or a singer or a piano player or something. And I don't, who knows where that comes from? You know, I don't know. And Jimmy came up in a totally different family. His dad would take them to, he would go play gigs with older people and I think at beer joints or something. And Jimmy's daddy would go there and he'd be drinking the beer and he had some relatives that played. And I think they'd sit around his house when he was a kid and they would play music and drink beer and stuff. And I mean, I never had that kind of thing, but I don't really know exactly. I've never really talked to him about it, but I don't really know exactly when he knew that he started playing younger than I was when I started playing. I started playing when I was about 14 or something. And he started playing, he and Stevie started playing when they were younger than that. And I don't really know what got them. I mean, Stevie might have got started playing because Jimmy did.
Sure.
But I don't really know how Jimmy decided to pick up the guitar in the first place. I don't know, yeah. but I mean, just, I can't, you know, I don't know about them any more than, I mean, you know, I know other people that have just as a child or, I mean, I can't really think of any right off that just, they just had something. You don't know what it is or where it came from. You know, you don't know, but I remember hearing about Jimmy when I was up in going to school up in Denton. Jimmy's 7 years younger than me. And he was playing around Dallas. He didn't, for one reason or another, he didn't have to worry about the draft for whatever reason. And so he was playing around and we called them Beatle bands because by the time Jimmy started being in his band, at least by his second band, when he was like 16 or 17, that's when the English stuff was already here. And so they were playing your first band, you were playing Yardbirds or Beatles or stuff like that. But Jimmy was I kept hearing his name, even though I was going to Denton and older than that crowd of people. I heard his name and I went and heard him in 67 playing he was sitting in with some other friends of mine on a matinee gig on a Sunday afternoon in Dallas. And I went to see my friends, I guess. But Jimmy and his band, the Chessmen, came in and they sat in and I think they played maybe a Beatles song, maybe a Yardbird song. Well, Jimmy played Jeff's Boogie.
Yeah, great.
And he played it. Not only did he just play it note for note, but he had the sound. You could just tell. I don't care if it's a cover. I don't care if it's Jeff's song. That guy's a good guitar player. You could just tell that he was a better guitar player than most people already at 16 or 17 or however old he was. I can tell a good guitar player when I hear one, you know. Sure. And I'd heard, had already been hearing his name. And even though they were just playing covers at the time, I was going, oh, that guy's good. And then, when I heard Stevie, I didn't know Stevie until a few, Stevie, I guess I met Stevie before he moved down here, because once Jimmy moved down here, Stevie had come down here, you know, and play or hang out or something. And I met Stevie. I probably met Jimmy when he was about 18, maybe 18, 19. And I met Stevie when he was probably 17, something like that. And I heard, Stevie's band called Blackbird, and he was 17, but you could tell that he had already latched on to the Albert King kind of thing. Mm. And it was obvious that it was a Albert King kind of thing, but he kind of had command of it. And it was, Albert King was such a, he had such an identifiable, cool take on shit that if Stevie picked up on it and incorporated it into everything he did, it was just cool. It just worked. And at first it seems like he was relying on that a lot, but still, even if he was relying on that, it still set him apart from everybody.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
And the way I would characterize the two of them is just me. It's like Jimmy really seemed to really get a lot from BB. Jimmy could nail BB really good. I've never been able to nail anybody, but Jimmy could, if he wanted to, just sound like BB and just learn the cool licks and the vibrato and everything. And Stevie went to Albert, you know. Right. Jimmy went to BB and Stevie went to Albert, and they both developed their own thing from that. But I think Stevie, to me, that was the difference. Maybe you're going to ask it later, but like Jimmy played less and Stevie played more. Jimmy played less notes. Stevie played more notes.
Sure.
But they were both, but audiences reacted to both of them. I mean, you know, it's people that even if they didn't like, there was something about the way they played. It might have been the fact that Jimmy just played BB so good, and people were hearing, like, it was almost like they were hearing what BB had played. Well, that sounds good. He's a good guitar player. But Jimmy was more than just, I'm not saying that's all Jimmy.
No, he was clearly.
But that seemed to really affect his thinking about playing the guitar. And the way Albert played, I mean, Stevie played a million times more notes than Albert did later on, you know, but Albert's approach.
The really power. Was, yeah. The power behind.
The power.
Yeah, for sure, man.
And so I think those are the main differences, but they were both so young to latch onto those cats. I mean, it's like when I was, it's hard to understand these days. I mean, there's always going to be some, you're always going to hear about some you got to hear this 14-year-old player. God, he's really good.
Yeah.
He sounds just like Stevie or something. I go, well, so do a whole lot of people these days. I'm kind of tired of hearing people that sound like Stevie, but it's a little bit more unusual to hear a 16-year-old sound like BB King,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, whatever, that's editorial there, but.
Let me ask you this, Denny, if it's even possible to answer this. You've had a pretty rich and, you know, robust career doing so many things. Is it possible for you to pick out maybe like the top three things, experiences that you've had either because of your role in it, the hang of the other people you're involved with, or, you know, just the actual music that you played? What would be like your top three, if that's even possible?
Well, I mean, I certainly would leave things out, but what was the category?
Well, you know, just the top three experiences you had musically, you know, and it could be for any reason, like your particular stuff that you did, you're particularly proud of, the experience in general, the personalities involved, you know, where it was just like the chemistry.
Just like when I talk about my life, it's hard to avoid talking about all that stuff I talked about early life. And in my later life, even though was much later, it's hard to talk about anything significant without talking about my years with Bob Dylan, even though I don't like to talk about that. But if you play with Bob Dylan for 5 years, there's no way that's not maybe the most significant thing I ever did, I guess.
Yeah. I was thinking
Bob Dylan.
Yeah. I was thinking that would be up there, man.
And, maybe just being in the Antone's house band for several years, because, we got to back up and get to know a little bit and hear a lot of our heroes that I never thought I'd ever get to hear. I mean, you know, Austin, Texas is a long, I mean, I traveled around a bit and I've heard people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world, but like to just live here in Austin and have those people come to you. And we had a great house band and we backed up some of the most heavy blues cats that were still, and there was through the 80s, there was lots of heavy blues cats still alive. I mean, I didn't back up T-Bone Walker and I didn't back up some people, but I mean, there's a long list of people that came to Antone's from 1975 till, well, now there's not many left now, but Antone's opened in 75. And I got another picture on my wall in there. I wasn't really a house band, but when Antone's first opened, it coincided with the Thunderbirds forming, with Jimmy and Kim and everything. And they kind of were the default house band. If Clifford brought in somebody and they didn't bring a whole band, the Thunderbirds were just getting together and Antone's was their home base. And so they backed up a lot of people. And one night, there were some nights, I mean, some nights it was unbelievable to us. I mean, some people don't even know who these people are, but I've got a picture on my wall in there where in the picture, all playing on the stage at the same time, John Lee Hooker's sitting there playing, big Walter Horton is playing harp, Eddie Taylor is playing guitar, who was an important guy behind the scenes, behind Jimmy Reed and a lot of other people. He made his own records and he's kind of obscure, but he's an important blues guy. Hubert Sumlin, who played lead on the Howlin' Wolf records.
Yeah.
And I have to look, but Keith Ferguson, Jimmy's bass player, but it was Big Walter, John Lee Hooker, Eddie Taylor, and Hubert Sumlin were just sitting there playing, and I'm on piano over there with them. But that was just a night at Antone's. That was just a night. And then things changed and they moved a couple of locations and there got to be we ended up needing a house band. And so I played guitar and piano in the house band and just the further you got into the 90s, the more of all of our blues heroes that we started losing.
Yeah.
But just, I mean, if all you did was think about from 75 till 1990, there was a cavalcade of blues giants that we got to hear and back up. And
did you work with Sue Foley when she was like basically a young girl or a young lady?
I think I played on a couple of tracks on a album, I think maybe. And she was, and I didn't ever play in a band with her, but I'm sure I was on stage with her, but I've actually been playing in the last couple of years, been playing some gigs with her.
Okay. Yeah.
She's been hanging out here and sometimes we do shows together. She'll do a show and I play with Lou Ann Barton and they are on the same show. And there's been a couple of gigs where Lou Ann Barton used me and Sue on guitar. So I in the last year or so, I've actually played with Sue more than I've ever played with her.
Yeah. Cause I had interviewed her a while back and she was telling me she basically came down to Antone's when she was like 17.
Yeah. I remember.
Yeah.
And she was good, but these days she's badass.
Yeah. She
looks real good and she plays good and she dresses good.
Yeah.
She's badass. She's badass. She scares me. She's badass.
Yeah, she's very talented, man. What would be number three? So you got Bob Dylan, all your experiences at Antone's. What would be number three?
Well, I was going to tell you the third thing.
Yeah, third thing.
I mean, I'm not sure exactly. I might answer it different on a different day. But anyway, so somewhere around 1990, this young guy from Adelaide came up here on a musical. I forgot the word I used a while ago.
Pilgrimage.
He went to probably maybe Memphis and New Orleans and maybe some other place, but he stuck around Austin a long time because he was a guitar player. they had, he had kind of an R&B band in Adelaide, just a little band. And he said, hey, look, why don't you come down to Australia? I've got a band. We'll back you up. We'll learn your songs and back you up, and we can book some gigs and just come down and have a good time, make a little bit of money and play. And I'd probably done a few gigs on my own, but that's not what I do really, you know, and I've certainly never toured in a country that didn't know me under my own name. And I didn't really know the band or him or anything. He had given me a 45 or a cassette or something. And I listened to it and it sounded like, well, it's kind of a Booker T kind of band, kind of R&B. And I mean, so there was kind of no reason for me to go, yeah, hell yeah. So I would, yeah, sure, I'll go do it. So I go down to, I mean, it was heavy for me because I went all the way to Australia.
Yes.
To play a month's worth of gigs, backing me up on a band that I was counting on to learn my songs, to go play instrumentals all over, well, not all over Australia, but a month's worth of gigs in Australia with guys I didn't know in a place that didn't know me. I said, yeah, okay, sure. So I go down there and they turn out to be real nice guys, and we rehearse and we have our first rehearsal a day or two after I'm there. And they had done all their homework and learned more of my songs than anybody here knew. And we were playing. I said, well, I said, to start off the rehearsal, I said, let's just play a shuffle. Let's just play. That's always a good barometer. So it sounded great. And the drummer, he was like young at the time, maybe 19 or something like that. He was young. Young Matthew, how'd you learn how to do that? He said, I just put on Albert Collins records and earphones, and I just played along with Albert Collins. Well, okay, that's a good way to learn a shuffle. So the fact that I was in Australia doing a tour under my own name, playing my own songs was, and I went back and did it a couple of years later, and that was significant to me that we were doing it, getting away with it, because I'd never, you know, I wouldn't have ever on my own thought, I know what, I'll go.
You're an artist now.
Go book a tour in Australia with a band I don't know. But it worked out great. And to this day, those guys are still my friends, my good friends, especially a couple of them that are brothers. They're still my good friends. But anyway, that meant a lot to me for them to ask me to do that. And I did a tour under my own name, I've done gigs, but that's the first time I ever went to another country and did a tour under my own name.
Yeah. That's a big, leap of faith.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Good for you, man. I'm glad that worked out. That's really cool. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. I would imagine you've played like hundreds and hundreds of guitars over the years. I was curious, what's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars might round out your top three?
Well, I don't know if I played that many over the years. I tend to have a few and keep them as long as I can keep them. I mean, I've still had several guitars, but... And sad to say, I don't really have. I've only got one guitar that I've. Well, I guess I've had it a long time now. I mean, I don't think of it as an old guitar, but my oldest guitar is a reissue Strat, but it was among the very first reissues that when they first started reissuing Strats, Clifford Antone got it for me, it's old and beat up now, and it's kind of my favorite guitar. And it's like whenever they first started doing that, their first reissues, I think it was like around 80, 81, something like that. I may be wrong, but I don't remember any. Seems to me like this is when they first started putting out a reissue.
I was going to say early 80s. So it's a reissue of what? It's like a 62 or a 58?
57, I think.
Do you have it handy?
Yeah.
Let me see. Can I see it, man? I'd love to.
So it's, you see it?
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's nice and That's nice. And that's a real relic. That's not a fake relic, man.
Right.
So
it's caught on fire. I think this is the one I put a cigarette up there and got kind of, I think I put it in my case with the cigarette still burning and I started to catch on fire. But all of this, it's all me.
Yeah. That's a,
I had somebody pinstripe it.
That's a rosewood neck. It looks like from here.
No.
Oh, it's
just a dirty worn.
Oh, wow, man. That is awesome. So let me describe it. It's a yellow. Can you hold it just a little higher, Denny? Yeah. Okay. So it's a white pick guard. It's a yellow. What color is that originally? Is it?
Well, they had a name for it. It was a little bit too yellow, kind of. I think it was supposed to look like a yellowed, whiter one or something.
Yeah.
You know, kind of cream colored. It wasn't banana bright yellow, but it wasn't yellow, but it was kind of yellowish, kind of.
Man, and the neck is so worn. It looks great, man.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, it was brand new when I got it. So
has that ever been refretted?
Oh yeah.
Wow. And is it the pickups or the, like, rewires of the original 57s? Yeah, that's cool, man. Very cool. Beautiful guitar, man. And
just regular guitars. I don't have that many. I might have about 12 or something. This is another one I like a lot. I can't play it that good, but
is that a 12 string? I can't see it.
No, it's a 175.
Okay. It's a 175. It's a beautiful guitar, man.
It's like a mid 60s. I've just had this about 10 years.
That's a beautiful guitar, man. Is there any cool story behind how you got that one?
Nope. I just kind of always wanted one and walked into my friend's music store, and I was playing with Bob at the time, I think, I had some money for one of the first times in my life, and I'd always wanted one, and I bought it. There's nothing wrong with the guitar, but I don't really play it so good. It's like the only guitar I really feel like I have any kind of control over is a Strat. Really, I've got a couple of Epiphone Firebirds, and I've got a Gibson V, and I've got four other Strats and a Epiphone hollow body region or something, and I kind of like, but people gave me about half of those. I've only bought about half of the guitars that I've got, but.
That's pretty good that people gave you five guitars, a bunch of those guitars, Denny.
Yeah.
That's not too common.
And it's in my car. I hadn't unloaded it, but like the thing that I'm really obsessing with right now as of about the last 3 or 4 years, I started getting into steel guitar. And I just played a gig last night, and it's still in the car. But this is another one I just bought. This is a
cool.
That's an old Supro right there. But my main guitar that I'm kind of obsessed with, and almost all I want to do, it's do you know steel guitars?
I have not played one. I've seen them, and I know steel guitars. I've never picked one up, to be honest with you.
Well, they're right. Well, I'd picked. Over the years, I might have approached one and I go pick up the bar or something, or try to put, I didn't know how to put on the finger. I didn't know how to put on the picks or anything about it. I go, never mind. It's too hard. I never really paid any attention to steel at all. Do you know Junior Brown?
California?
Junior Brown.
Yeah. Is he in California?
No, steel player.
But is he out of California? No, I don't know him.
You're thinking of Junior Watson?
Yeah. Sorry. Yes.
No, Junior Brown is he's a really amazing steel player. He's actually had some success, a certain amount of success. He's the Have you heard of he plays guitar and steel, and he had a dream, and he was always playing steel and picking up a guitar, playing steel, picking up a guitar. And he had a dream about this thing, and he had it made, and it's called a Git Steel. And so it's like half guitar and half steel and one, well, maybe it's more than one piece of wood glued together, but he stands up and he's got he can reach down and play the steel, but on the stand attached to the piece of wood of the steel is a guitar. So he can,
where's he out of?
Well, I'm not sure where he lives right now, but I don't know if he's from New Mexico or what, but he showed up in town back in the 80s, and I used to go hear him play, and I never really was into country or anything, and never really given any thought to steel guitar. And he doesn't play pedal; he plays non-pedal. He moved to town and was playing with different people, and I was hearing him in non-country, because I just at the time I didn't really care about country, and I was hearing him in non-country context, and I was kind of hearing the steel for the first time, and I thought, well, now that I'm in the room with it, I like it; it sounds good. And then he started going over to Jimmy's house, and Jimmy started getting into it, and Jimmy bought a couple. And I guess Junior showed him some things, and all of a sudden Jimmy's playing steel guitar. And I had Jimmy play. And not long after that, I started making my first record, and I had Jimmy play steel on my first two albums. And Jimmy played really good, really quick. He was really good, real quick. And so I've kind of just been a fan of steel ever since, but I didn't think I could play one. And then a few years ago, I came across one at my girlfriend's house that had belonged to her ex-husband. And I said, "Where'd that come from?" And she said, "That was DK's." And I said, and he had passed away. And I said, "I'm taking that home." And I wanted to take the steel guitar. This is a few years ago. I said, "I didn't really want to pay $400 for one and not be able to play it, but I would take this one home and spend some time with it." So I took it home and started messing with it, and I wasn't going to give up until I actually spent a little bit of time with it. And I spent some time with it, and I was going, "Gosh, I wonder, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can." And I kind of figured out the neck and the layout of the strings and all that wasn't that big a deal. The hard part was playing in tune with the bar and the finger picks. The technique of playing it was what was really hard. But I thought, wow, but it sounds so cool, and maybe I could do it. But I'm going to, anyway, that's what got me started. And then I ended up buying a little practice $100 one. And then I got a 6-string Fender. And then this friend of mine loaned me her double neck 8-string Fender, old one. And then I bought another Fender. And then Charlie Sexton loaned me an old double neck Rickenbacker, and then I came across this, the other. So now I'm kind of obsessed with steel guitars. They're all tuned different, and the double neck Fender is the one I'm kind of obsessing on now. And I'm not really playing blues on it. This regular gig that I have on Wednesday, it's the same personnel as the Friday gig. But we do, it's all total hillbilly. It's Webb Pierce, Lefty Frizzell, Hank Williams, Hank Snow, Ernest Tubb, all that. That's all we do. And that's the kind of steel playing I like, old school, non-pedal. That's what I'm just kind of obsessed about. It was funny, last night I actually broke a string, because there's this trick where you bend a string with your finger to make it kind of sound like a steel guitar effect. And I broke the string when I did it, and it was near the end of the gig, so it wasn't that big a deal. I was thinking, well, I broke a string. Well, I've only got 15 strings left on this guitar. I make it through the rest of the night.
You can handle it. You can swing it. Man, it's good to see you so enthusiastic about something, you know.
Well, no, it's great, because that's exactly the point, because in the recent past, I'd realized that I wasn't really getting all that excited about much, you know. And in the past, there was always kind of something to get into or excited about or something. And I realized, God, it seems like it's been a long time But once I picked up that steel guitar and brought it home, the last few years, I mean, I try to practice a couple of hours every day.
That's great. And
this gig that we do on Wednesday, that's what I look forward to more than anything.
The blues and, gig.
No, the country gig.
Oh, the country gig. Okay, right, right.
And my girlfriend's little grandbaby and the steel guitar. I mean, I like all my other gigs. So I play a lot. I play 15 times a month, I guess. But I'm really, really, really lucky because I have something that makes me happy. To just play my steel guitar every day, that makes me happy to do that.
That's
and I'm
cool.
I'm finally actually kind of getting over this plateau to where I can trick people into thinking I play good.
I don't think you got to trick anybody, man.
Well, I mean, I'm still obviously a student, but there's certain things I can do. It's just like I'm not a piano player. I'm not an organ player, but I can make people think that I am.
You've done a pretty good job of it.
Well, I know what all my limitations are. Mm. So I have too many limitations to call myself a piano player or an organ player. I mean, it's funny. I go play an organ every once in a while. I don't have one, but I like it. They have one at Antone's or this other club. Somebody will ask me to play an organ sometime. And it's funny because I bet I'm the only guy that ever plays an organ gig. When I get there, I go, now, how do you turn this thing on now? I always, is it start first or run first? Another day I went, you hold down the start for 10 or 15 seconds and then pull the other switch and that starts it. But I was doing that the other day and it was going, okay, I think I got that right, but it's not starting. No noise. And then I asked somebody and somebody came up there and said, well, why don't you plug this in right here? One of the cables, it was in the dark and I didn't realize that it was it's funny to go play, to get paid to play an instrument. And you go, now, how do you start this thing?
Hey, thank God for that. You know, that's a good problem that you're having. The only, I interviewed a couple of steel players. One of them plays in Austin once in a while. Cindy Cashdollar.
She left town. She, right as I was starting to play, she moved back to
Woodstock. Yeah. She's a hell of a player, man.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
And another guy, do you know Russ Paul?
No.
He's out of Nashville. Russ is out of Nashville. Yeah,
I'm trying to take some lessons here. I've taken a couple, but I need to take some more. But I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with it. That's great, man. I remember Jimmy said, it's just got the ultimate guitar tone. And I thought about it and I went, yeah.
Hey, quickly, just to interrupt, I just thought of this. I'm sure that was a pretty significant experience working with Bob Dylan for 5 years. And I was curious, how did you get that gig in the first place?
Well, I'm not really sure of all the chronology of it, but a year before I got the gig, a friend of mine that manages Jimmy Vaughn called me up and he said, hey, look, Bob wants Jimmy to go out with him because one of his guitar players is sick and he just wants somebody to go out for 2 or 3 weeks to finish up this tour. But Jimmy's wife is getting ready to have twins and he can't go. And so Corey said, I want to tell him about you. And I said, well, tell him about me. So Corey, the manager, got with Bob's people and said, Jimmy can't do it, but have I got the guy for you? And they said, well, I don't know who that guy is. And so we overnighted him a couple of my CDs and didn't really hear anything for a while. And I found out later that they were up in New England when this happened, I think. And they called up somebody that they knew that they had actually worked with before. And they had him just come in and finish up the tour. And then he actually stayed on. And then a year later, I got a call from somebody a year after that initial thing that didn't really happen. I got a call from his office saying, can you come to Los Angeles and rehearse with Bob Dylan? And I was going, rehearse? What for? I'm not in his band. Why am I want to rehearse with him? You know? But I didn't. All I said was, of course, Well, yeah, sure.
Sure, yeah.
And so I went out there, and I actually knew the bass player a little bit, and I knew the road manager, but I didn't know the rest of the guys. But Charlie Sexton had already worked with them. And so there was an Austin connection with the road manager, and the bass player had lived in Austin. And I didn't know it for a long time, but Jimmy and Stevie had actually recorded with Bob. I didn't even know that, but they had recorded with him. And I think they're playing on a few tracks on some record. I don't even know what it is, but I didn't know that. But the point is the organization had experience with Charlie and the road manager and Tony and Jimmy and Stevie. They had had all this experience with Austin people, you know, and a year later, after that initial call, they decided to make a change in the band. And so they needed a guitar player. And so I guess they were going, well, who are we going to get? And they didn't know me, but I think that they said, well, who was that guy we called last year? And well, didn't he send a couple of CDs or something? And anyway, all I know is I knew that they had, my friend had submitted my name a year before, and then they followed up on it a year later. And I went out to rehearse with them for 3 days. And at the end of every rehearsal, those 3 days in Santa Monica there, at the end of every day, I was going, well, if this is an audition, I ain't getting this gig.
You know? Why? You didn't think you played well, or?
Well, it wasn't that. It was just so crazy. And a new person in the band that they had just hired was this Alana James, a woman fiddle player. And they also hired Don Heron from BR-549, who played steel and banjo and mandolin and everything like that. And I'm sitting over here and I'm looking, well, there's a girl over there playing a fiddle, and here's a guy holding a banjo. And I'm going, the hell am I doing here? You know, I've never played with a banjo before, you know.
It was more like a country band.
Right. And they were getting ready to, go out, and Merle Haggard was going to play on the bill with them.
Okay.
And so they even rehearsed some songs, but they were just playing anything. They were just jamming and playing just anything, just kind of jamming. It wasn't that much of a rehearsal. They were just playing and kind of checking everybody out, but it was kind of chaotic, and they were playing songs that I'd never heard before. Some of his songs, I'd never heard them before. And some country songs and some stuff. And I'm pretty good at playing on the fly, you know, but I didn't really feel like I did very good. And I was doing, what am I doing here? Are they going to go out with Merle Haggard? They got a banjo and a steel guitar over there and a fiddle here and a fiddle there. And I was going, golly. And then, after the third night, they said, well, if I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know what we're going to do. But would you be interested in going out with us if we decide to, you know, well, that's what we want to do? And I said, well, yeah, sure. And so I left and went where I was staying, because I was living in Dallas at the time. And later that night, they called me and said, we want to offer you the gig. And I went, well, I was really shocked, really. And I said, you mean you want to go out and try it out? And they said, no, we're offering you the gig. And I went, okay. But I was thinking, yeah, we'll see about this. But anyway, I did it for nearly 5 years, and I can only assume that when they decided to get a guitar player a year later, that they listened to my CDs and probably thought, well, this guy plays okay, you know, I don't know, let's give him a call. I don't even know who else to call. You know, they didn't really know. I mean, I knew the bass player Tony Garnier, and I knew the road manager. And I knew Charlie, who had already played with him, but I didn't know anybody in the organization at the time. But I went out with them, and
you played on a Grammy-winning record. You get a platinum.
Yeah, I got a year after I joined up, we recorded Modern Times, and I'm real proud of that. And then we went, when I was with him over that period of time, every once in a while, we would go into a studio. I remember we went in Nashville one day, and I think in somewhere in Ireland, and so, I don't know, all over the place. Every once in a while, we'd go in the studio to record something, and we wouldn't even really know what it was for. We'd record one song or two songs, and they wouldn't even really tell us what it was for or something. But and then some of those tracks have ended up on miscellaneous Bob Dylan albums. I mean, there's so many bootlegs out there, but and I think some of those tracks might have ended up on officially released records, but I don't really know. I don't even know. You know, I don't know. I'm saying is that was the only album I played on all the way through, and then just miscellaneous tracks that ended up here and there.
I think I once read something that he's the most bootleg artist, but he's also been around longer than anybody else, I think.
Well, yeah, but these days, I mean, I wasn't aware of like the term bobhead, you know, but it's, I became aware of that pretty quick, you know, and it's like,
it's like a deadhead.
These people are fanatical in that they want to know every scrap of information about him or anybody that plays with him or anything. And they, by the time the way we operated, we'd do a gig and then after the show, go straight to the bus and drive to the next town. That's just, I mean, there was exceptions, but that's the way we operated. And in every case, by the time we got where we were going, the bootlegs were already released to the thousands of bobheads all over the world because
from the last show.
These days, you can't stop somebody from recording the show. You know, they got recorders and microphones that you put in your shirt pocket, you know, and they have some really good gear. And there's these certain guys that record every single show, and they post them on every gig that he plays. By the time the band wakes up, the previous gig is all over the internet.
Well, you know, that's why I think bands like Government Mule are so successful, because they have a recording studio. They record every show and then they put it up at studio, soundboard quality, and then they post it up for sale the next day. So they've turned that and said,
well, you might as well, because you can't stop it. It's not like, there's no way to, you can't stop it. Just like you can't stop somebody from taking a picture, you know,
right.
You can't, with the technology today, you cannot stop somebody from, and a lot of those recordings are very good quality. So you can't stop it. So you either just go, okay, go ahead, or you do it yourself and put it up. But they don't, the organization doesn't have to do it, because they got people out there every night with expensive gear recording it and putting it up for them, you know. And it doesn't seem to hurt their shows or anything else. So, they don't seem to mind so much.
No, but I think Mule is really smart, because it's like, and you're selling a record for 10, you know, a digital recording for 10 bucks. So you think, is it worth it for me to pay $10 to get the best quality recording versus getting some bootleg? To me, I'd pay the money every day, you know. Plus, I just support artists, but, you know, and I value intellectual property. But, you know, I think guys like that are smart. There's a couple of bands that Peter Frampton did that when I saw Frampton when he did the 35th anniversary tour of Frampton Comes Alive. It was about 10 years ago. They had the same thing. Right after the show, you could buy the record. They were pressing them right there.
Well, everything's different, and you have to adapt. You just have to adapt to it one way or another, you know, and sometimes it actually ends up working for you, you know. I mean, especially if you have fans that just love you and are loyal and want everything that you ever do, or, you know, so you don't want to upset your fans.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thanks for sharing that story. Let me ask you just about music in general. If I asked you to pick your three Desert Island discs, I know this is a tough question for you because you like a lot of music. You've been around a while. In no particular order, Denny, albums?
I saw that you were going to ask that, so I thought about it, and I also realized, well, this is, you know, it would be tough to put 100 albums on.
Right.
But one of them, a safe one, would be Kind of Blue.
Miles.
And I would have to have maybe a Jimmy Reed a Jimmy Reed album called I'm Jimmy Reed. And then there's a more obscure album by this, I guess you'd call it Western Swing guy from the early 60s, a live album called Brisbane, B-R-I-S-B-A-N-E, from Brisbane, California, not Australia, Brisbane Bop, B-O-P, by a guy named Jimmy Rivers. It's just the most incredible. It's a live gig. The drummer would just take his reel-to-reel and set it up on stage and record gigs for his own. And I there's very little recorded output by this outfit, but somehow the drummer got a good enough recording of this one particular. I think it was maybe on one night, and some label put it out. There was a real popular band, and they were an excellent band, and they put out somehow this drummer's home recording. I mean, his recording. He ended up on vinyl. I don't even know when it was when it was released at first, but a friend of mine gave me made me a cassette of it about 25 years ago. And I wanted to download it, a digital copy. I actually uploaded the vinyl, but I wanted a better copy. So I went to download a copy of it, and it wasn't available for download. I had to buy by now they had put out a CD of it. So I bought the CD, but it's a steel guitar and guitar. It's like a, it's like a country band, but these guys, they play, they're so badass playing that, I mean, the people that, I mean, I can picture the kind of honky tonk joint that this, where it was. It was just an old school dance hall beer joint where people dance in the middle of the club, I guess. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't have any pictures of it, just a mental image of these guys. It's a live gig they're playing. And these guys play so good. They kick ass so much on steel and on guitar and everything. They sing and they do jazz instrumentals and they sing and they play, and the songs are great. They play some jazz standards and they sing some jazz standards and they sing some country songs, but it's really danceable. And the people that are there, I mean, I'm sure some of them probably appreciate the masterfulness of the actual playing, but these people don't, I mean, a lot of people, they're just going there to dance and drink and have a good time. And there's some applause after those songs, but if I was there, I'd have been screaming till I was hoarse for every song, because it was badass jazz. It was as good a jazz playing as you could hear, whether it was on steel or guitar, but it was jazz with a country flavor that you could dance to. And I don't know. Ever since my friend made that vinyl copy of that, it's been one of my favorite albums. And the Miles, That Kind of Blue, I don't know. I don't know. It's possible to get tired of that. And I've been listening to Jimmy Reed since I was about 14, and I still love it as much now as I always did. I mean, it's hard to pick three, but that just turned out to be a jazz, a blues, and, well, I don't even know if you call Jimmy Reed blues, but let's call it blues. And then the Jimmy Rivers, I guess, call it Western swing. So I didn't even really look to put a different category for each three, but that's the way it ended up.
Cool,
but
man.
I could have a lot longer list than that, as you know.
Oh God. Yeah. When you played with, when Merle was opening for you guys, just to switch back for a second.
I think he always played before we did.
Who was his guitar player? Was it Red?
No.
That was later on.
He played some guitar, but I didn't, Red wasn't on that show. And I can't even, he had a fiddle player and a keyboard player. And I know he played some guitar. I'm sure he had a guitar player. I mean, this was in 05. So I actually don't remember. It was real good, but I don't know the guitar. If he had he probably did have a guitar player and probably had a really good one, but yeah. I don't remember who it was.
Did you ever bump into Red in Austin?
Red? Oh yeah.
Yeah. Really good guy. Really good
Yeah.
Guy. All right. Let's talk. Those are good selections, by the way. Thank you. What's the most important things that you've learned about yourself throughout your whole career, man, and going through this, you know, up and down journey?
Well, that's a hard one. I thought about that, and I don't really know that I know how to answer that. I don't know. Lately, I think I mentioned I've been examining my whole life, maybe more than I ever did, and I kind of disappointed in some of the stuff I see. I'm trying to be more mindful of things and not so. I mean, I've always tried to be a good guy and a nice guy and an honest guy. I always tried to do that, you know. But I've been kind of shy and didn't maybe have confidence or wasn't quite ambitious enough, or I don't know. I mean, I feel like I dropped the ball and need a bunch of do-overs, but I don't really know exactly how to get very specific about that. I don't know. Part of who I am, the way I'm grateful for the way I grew up, because I had a stable family and everything, but I also, I'm kind of late at usually I get around to doing most things I want to do and learn, but I'm kind of slow, and it takes me longer to get around to doing things and knowing things and realizing things, just because my parents were kind of strict and I was kind of held back and strict and slower than people that kind of.
A little sheltered?
Yeah. And that was, I don't know that I regret that, except for the fact that when you have it rougher on, I mean, I'm really grateful that my whole childhood was totally secure and safe and warm and fuzzy, basically, you know, compared to a lot of people. You know, my parents didn't fight, they didn't drink, nobody went to jail, nobody got hurt. There wasn't any kind of tragedy or tragic stuff, traumatic stuff in my childhood. But at the same time, people that grow up a little rougher, a little harder, might be a little bit more prepared for some things, you know. And I was just sheltered. I think that, you know, being sheltered is not a bad thing, but it can also delay certain things.
No, I totally get that.
And I mean, it's not really a bad thing, but in some ways it kind of made things a little bit harder for me, maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I tried to be a good guy, but I think I might have should have had more confidence, or maybe a little more ambition or something. I don't know. And one thing I learned that, and it goes all the way back to my first band in high school, is like, I've been in situations where I didn't want to hurt somebody's. I mean, I've rarely had my own band. I'm usually just the guy in a band. Sometimes more of an influential member than other times. But sometimes I have had to put up with, well, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but I've played with people that maybe weren't as good as the rest of us. And I didn't want to hurt somebody's feelings, but I was going, man, I wish we had a different drummer. That's happened a few times. And if your drummer's weak, you don't want anybody that's weak.
Yeah.
But I played with some weak players, and I just didn't want to rock the boat. But and a lot of times in my early career, I talked about how I got delayed because of the military situation and all that kind of stuff. A lot of times I was thinking, oh, what the hell difference does it make? Because I can't pursue this on a serious level anyway. So I just want to go play some gigs and make some money. And this band's not perfect and it's not great, but if it was, I just have to lose it anyway.
Because you had that thing hanging over your head.
Because of that thing, you know, if that hadn't been the case, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure, you know how I would have proceeded with my life had I been more free to do what I wanted to when I wanted to do it. But that, I mean, you know, like I talked about it, just that situation seemed to control my life for so long that I just felt like almost everything was out of my control anyway. So a lot of things just didn't even, nothing even mattered that much what I was doing.
Hmm. I totally get
just
that.
Had to do whatever I had to do to survive and get by and try to figure out a way to get through all that.
I totally understand that. I think a lot of people have stuff like, you know, something that has dictated a negative influence on their life, and it does paralyze you, whether it's something from your childhood or something that you had to deal with, like in your case with the service, but something that you feel removed control from you, and it's just hard to overcome that.
Yeah.
Who's had the biggest influence on you, Denny, both musically and personally?
Well, I was thinking about that too. And I don't even know. I mean, maybe just the way I grew up, my family, just their values and the things that, I mean, I'm 74, but I've talked about it with my sister. And sometimes we still think our parents are looking over our shoulder and seeing what we do. And we think, well, crap, you know, I wish I could get away with that, you know? And I don't know. I can't really think of any. There hadn't really been an older person, or I can't really think of anybody in particular that's really influenced me so much. And what was the other one?
It was musically or personally.
Oh, musically, that's almost impossible to say too. Like I was saying, my first music was the first rock and roll.
Little Richard, Chuck Berry,
all that kind of stuff, all that stuff from 55 and 56 and 57. But living in Dallas, Dallas was a good blues town, really. I mean, maybe not on the AM Top 40 white radio, but later at night. And there was definitely elements around Dallas that were aware of blues and love blues. And well, even in Dallas, even girls in high school and squares knew who Bobby Blue Bland was, and Ray Charles and Lightnin' Hopkins and Little Richard and John Lee Hooker and Jimmy Reed. Dallas was a Jimmy Reed town, and Lightnin' Hopkins and Freddie. And I learned about Chess Records and Excello Records, the blues labels and the blues guys just almost immediately after that other stuff. And I couldn't really, who had the most influence on me? I don't know. I wouldn't know how to, I can't think of any one person that musically I could think of maybe 30.
Most important thing your mom taught you, the most important thing you learned from your mom.
Well, I was thinking about that too. I don't know. She was just a very sweet woman. Everybody loved her. She wasn't all that educated. I mean, she certainly wasn't stupid, but she wasn't, my parents weren't educated and they're all sophisticated and everything, but Mother was just, she was just a fine woman, just a good woman and a nice woman. And her mom and her sisters and everything were just nice, sweet women. And they just wanted everybody to be happy and be nice. And I think I must have absorbed some of that, because I noticed one thing about me that I don't know if it's good or bad, but like I'm too much of a touchy. I just, when I like people or I just touch people, if I, you know, if they're,
yeah.
And go, well, stop it, you know, but I just, when I really like somebody, I almost feel like but when it comes to girls or women, I always make sure that when I do it in a very, restrained, non-threatening.
Yeah. I get that.
It's not lecherous when I do that.
Right. I totally get it.
I mean, I'm not that way. I don't do that, but I realized that, well, some people may not like for me to touch them like that. You know? I mean, some people I know do, because I have girls that come up to me to get their hugs, you know, but then lately I've just realized, well, golly, you know, maybe I need to tone it down, but I don't know. Mother, I don't know. If she, I don't remember her sitting down and saying, okay, son, da da da, you know, or my dad saying, okay, son, I know that my dad didn't want me to be a lazy bum. He was always want me to get up and get out of bed and go pull some weeds or paint the redwood fence or go sand a car that he was getting ready to tape or just do anything. Just get out of the damn bed and go do some work.
Is it the most
guy he wanted? They just wanted me to be a decent person to pull my own weight and, you know, treat people good and not be a lazy bum or something, I guess.
Is that the most important thing your dad taught you, work ethic?
I guess so. I guess so. And I mean, and if he thought I misbehaved or did, you know, I'm old enough to where, you know, you'd get a whipping or but it was worse for him because I wasn't really all that scared of him, but he had the power and I was a kid. And if he wanted to ground me or make sure I pulled some extra weeds or something like that, I'd have to do what he said. And he just didn't want me to be a bad kid, you know, and it was kind of rough. I think I had it rougher than a lot of other kids, but I mean, it wasn't that bad. I mean, he was still a nice man and there was certainly never any abuse, but he grew up in a small, both of my parents grew up in Waxahachie, Texas, very small, little cozy little North Texas town with small town values. And I mean, they were all really good people, nice people, but it was a pretty isolated, conservative environment that my parents grew up in. And I think they might have been a little bit glad to get away from it, you know, because my parents left their hometown of Waxahachie and went to Hillsborough, Texas, down the road, I guess about the time, seems like to me like maybe about as soon as they could, but maybe they wanted to get away from some of that too. But still, all my relatives were just small town people with small town values, and they were all good people and just people laughing. And I mean, I really like all my relatives. They're just happy, nice people. There's not many, there's hardly any left, but my dad came from a big family, and I don't know. They just, my parents just wanted me to have their small town values. And I guess what made it hard was, well, I was growing up in Dallas in the 50s and the 60s, you know, and it was a totally different world from what they grew up in. And it was kind of hard to be that guy in that world that I was growing up in. Yeah. You know, I think Elvis Presley and Little Richard scared them to death, you know. I mean, and that was just in the 50s. And
then
compared to anything else, that's really, you can't get much tamer than that looking back, you know.
But, no, totally. What's the toughest decision you've ever had to make or the hardest thing you've ever had to do?
Well, that probably the first thing that pops into my mind was just going back to that military thing and how to deal with that situation of getting out of high school in 1962 and knowing that the draft is waiting to get me. And that just seemed like such a scary, traumatic. I mean, not scared in the sense that I was, I mean, there wasn't a war going on. I wasn't scared about, you know, going and getting blowed up. I just was just going, okay, I'm finally out of high school. I can get out of the house. What do I want to do? Go stay out all night and chase girls and play music? Or do I want to go to a boot camp? You know, and I knew I didn't, you know, but I couldn't, I didn't really have any options. Like I was saying, if I said I'm just going to get a band and play, I would have gotten drafted within months and get up in boot camp anyway. So I had the options were go to school or join one of the branches or get drafted or something. And that was just a heavy decision to have to make. And for me, none of the options were good, but it was a real hard decision.
Best advice you've ever been given and who gave it to you?
Well, I was thinking about that too. It might be, I think I'd already mentioned this, but you know, my dad and me, we had it kind of rough there after I started growing up and getting out of the house and trying to actually live as a musician and being broke all the time and everything. And we didn't get along at all. It was very tense and mother had to suffer and it was a real drag and everything. It was a drag for me. And he was embarrassed by me, I think, and made me not like him. And I think I was embarrassed by him, and he was embarrassed by me, and he didn't like me, and I didn't like him, blah, blah, blah. It was just a great big drag. And then this friend of mine comes over to my house, and I'm telling him about the latest episode and about my dad. And my friend goes, "Hey, man, you need to."
Yeah, you got to get that shit cleaned up or something like that.
You got to get that cleaned up. And I was going, "Huh?" But he's a big drag. And he was going, "That don't matter. You need to get that cleaned up. That's a good way to put it." And I don't know. I don't really even recall getting that much. I don't know. I'm sure people have given me advice that I didn't want to hear throughout my life. But I think that might be the. I mean, that was. I would consider that advice.
Yeah. You
know? And that's really specific. And I don't really know that I had advice that clear cut offered to me. I know, maybe so. I just can't remember. But that was a big one. That was probably as important as anything, because after that happened, I eventually, you know, I started thinking about it, and eventually I did my part to try to, or I did my part to try to deal with that situation and try to smooth it over. And I think that was really important. So I'm grateful to my, that was just a friend of mine.
You still in touch with this guy?
I hadn't seen him in a really long time. No, I'm not.
Hmm. And man, I'm going to ask you the last question. I can't thank you enough. You've been so generous with your time and like so sincere. I really appreciate it. And I'm really glad that I had this conversation with you. What's been the biggest change in your personality, Denny, over the last 10 years, let's say, or even 15? And how much of this change has been deliberate and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Well, I think that's the hardest question yet. And I'm sorry, but I don't really know. I don't really know how to answer that. I don't really know that I've changed. I don't know if I've, I mean, I probably should have, but I don't really know. I don't really know that I have changed for a long time. I've been doing a lot of, maybe it's because I'm feeling older and stuff, but I look back on my life and I see a lot of mistakes that I've made, situations maybe I blew, some situations where I needed a do-over, and I'm not all that proud of a lot of my behavior sometimes. But I mean, basically I try to be a good person. I mean, I'm an honest person. I'm not a violent person. I like people and I like to get along with people and I like positive things. I mean, I'm flawed, course. But I've just said and done stupid things that I can remember it. They're just popping into my head all the time. Oh yeah. What about that stupid ass thing you said or did? I mean, I wish I could stop thinking about them and have them pop in my head, but I've lived long enough to where I have made a lot of mistakes and I'm trying to, be aware of them and not do that kind of stuff again, but I don't really know that I've.
You don't think you've changed at all in the last 10 or 15 years?
Huh?
You don't think you've changed much over the last 10 or 15 years?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know if I've changed that much. I mean, I've gotten, I don't know. You know, it's like ever since I moved here in 1970, you know, it's been real nice because, by being a guitar player that never got married, never had kids, I've been able to maintain my arrested development. And I still feel like I'm the, well, when I moved here in 1970, came here ready to play. I wanted to play. I felt freedom. And I was the first time I was starting to get this taste of freedom and trying to shake off all these other obligations. And I just wanted to play music, be in a band, play music, that's, and live a life that was based around playing music and learning how to play it better. And I mean, I like girls, and I like cars, and I like music. And I mean, I like to read and try to be informed about stuff. And I have other interests. You know, I'm interested in history and current events and stuff like that. But basically, I'm fortunate in that. I mean, it's been a struggle, but I've just been a guitar player for a really long time, and I'm really happy that I've been one. I got really, really scared right before I got the Bob gig, because things hadn't really ended up working out so good. And it's a great, it's one thing to be broke when you're 25 or 30, but it's another thing to be broke when you're 60, you know. That's like, oh, there's nothing. I mean, it was awful and scary and frightening. But other than that, I don't know. I don't really see how I'm much different than I've always been. I hope I've got my stuff together a little better, you know, and I try to deal with things more responsibly. But I never was that bad about being irresponsible, other than just being a guy that never got married and had kids and had obligations and stuff like that. But I don't really know that I've changed any over the 15 years, or gosh, even longer than that. Maybe I have. I hope I'm getting a little stronger and a little wiser, but sometimes I doubt that. I don't know that I've changed. I try to be wiser, but lately I'm thinking, golly, I never really thought I had any more than just average intelligence. I thought, well, at least I've got that. I think I'm, you know, I never really thought I was all that brilliant. I think I probably got at least average intelligence. But as time goes on, I'm going, well, I don't know, maybe not. maybe I don't have, maybe not. I don't know. Life's hard, and it's hard and it's complex, and I don't know. It's scary, but I mean, I'm happy and I'm real glad to be here. And I probably should have changed a bunch of things, but I don't know that I really have. I can't really see anything that I've changed. I still like what I've ever liked, and I don't know.
Well, man, for whatever it's worth, I think you're probably a guy who's hard on himself, and I think the world sees you in a different light than you might see yourself sometimes. So for whatever that's worth.
Well, it's worth something. Thanks. I appreciate it. That'd be nice.
I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing everything, man. Honestly, this is really nice and very kind of you. And I think a lot of people are going to enjoy this. And I want to tell people where they can get turned on to you. First of all, it's Denny Freeman, Freeman. And check out his website. It's dennyfreeman.com, correct?
Yeah.
Denny's got 3 standing gigs that he plays. And it's Tuesday night at Antone's from 6:30 to 8:30. This is in Austin. So if you're in the Austin area, or if you're in anywhere near and you want to go take a nice trip to see some great blues playing or some country playing, let me tell you what the gigs are. It's every Tuesday night at Antone's from 6:30 to 8:30. Plays a great blues set. Say hello to him and tell him you enjoyed listening to his interview. On Wednesday nights from 6:30 to 9:00, he plays at Sea Boys Heart and Soul, and it's a country set. And on Friday night, he plays at the Saxon Pub, which is pretty well known in Austin, and plays a blues rock set, and that's at 6:30 to 8:00. And so go and check Denny out, and also go to his website, and he's got some CDs there of his for sale. Check him out and support his music. And if you bump into him, tell him you said hey. Any famous or final last words of wisdom?
Well, no, I just really appreciate the fact that you took the time to do this. I really appreciate it, and I enjoyed it. So,
thank you. Me too. I'm glad I did it. Thanks again, man. I really do appreciate it. Cool. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Denny Freeman for spending time with us. Check him out online at dennyfreeman.com, and check him out Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays in Austin at Antone's, Sea Boys Heart and Soul, and at the Saxon Pub. Thanks again to Denny for coming here. I really appreciate it. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list, and you can do that right now. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice.
choose wisely. Be nice. Go play. And bandmates, and we're constantly gigging. Denny played with Jimmy Vaughn's